All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
So today we're going to be talking about a book that we kind of teased last week on a one of our previous episodes, Sean. Yeah. This is called Executive Seduction. No.
Is it? That's not right.
It should be renamed. I renamed it.
Oh, man. You're going to get us in trouble already.
Executive Power.
Executive Power, yeah. And it's actually kind of an old book. It's about 10, 11 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
And I stumbled across this guy, the author, with another book called If God Were Your Therapist or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way he wrote and the way he wrote, I really liked it. So I started looking at his other books, and I saw he had a lot of stuff about persuasion and influence and those kind of things. So we got the old Executive Power from the old Amazon, and it's pretty dense and textbooky, but it's got a lot of really good stuff in it. And we're going to zero in this episode on one chapter, probably the most, which is the one you mentioned, Master the Art of Charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And with the complete psychological formula for instant likability. So nothing is more persuasive than likability.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So before we get into our beers, I want to read this one quote. It has nothing to do with what I just said, but the quote is so good and so timely from this book that I wanted to read it.
Okay.
And this is on the chapter about spin control, which is, always timely in our world.
Absolutely. See a lot of spin going on these last 2 weeks.
So here's the quote, and I don't know if you read it or if you remember who said it, but I'll see if you do. Insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epics, it is the rule.
Yeah, never more appropriate than right now.
Yeah. None of us are as dumb as all of us.
It is true, though, man.
Yeah, it wasn't the author. So do you know who said it? Yeah.
The author, let's see.
Who's the speaker or the writer of that quote? It wasn't the author of the book. I'll give you that hint.
Okay.
And so you have to pick from the other 8 billion people plus all the dead people.
I want you, just for our audience's sake, and so I can think about it a little more, can you repeat that quote?
Yes. Insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epics, it is the rule.
Is it, all right, give me a hint. Is it going back, is it recent, or are we going back maybe 50 years or more?
50-ish years, I think.
50-ish. Okay. So, that helps.
How about we reveal it after we talk about our drinks?
Okay, that's good.
That'll give you some time to think about it.
Yep.
And that'll give us a good teaser to get people to hang on for the riddle, the answer to the riddle.
All right, I've got a good guess. Got
to get them to hang on for something.
Yeah. Well, if they can't hang on for beer, then forget about them.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So right. You said you had a good beer for this episode, so I'm curious what you got.
All right.
Mine's a rerun, so... Not of the last episode, but of a previous episode.
Oh, okay. Well, this is an original, and I can't tell you it's good or not because I haven't even had it. But I like the name, and it stood out, and I think it's somewhat appropriate for this time. It's called Emergency Drinking Beer.
Yes.
I picture this as like you breaking the glass, if you have nothing else left. And, you're in the apocalypse. I guess this is what you break out, a little bit of emergency drinking beer.
I like it. So is that like a lager?
It's a Pilsner, actually. It is, let me pull it up here. Like I said, this will be my first sip. And let's see.
I'm renaming this beer Irony. Based on its clarity and the fact that it's almost indistinguishable from water.
Is that it? That's what it looks like? Oh, man. That's
no, I'm clear. Enjoying it. It's just, subtly hinting at y'all making fun of me for IPAs.
It is pretty light looking at Jason's glass. I haven't poured it yet. That is super light. It's a German Pilsner, but you know what? German, most Pilsners are pretty light.
This is nothing like an American Pilsner.
So can you see that?
I can.
Because I'm looking at this. So it's actually, it's only 4.5% ABV, but it's a German Pilsner from a Wild Heaven beer. Wild Heaven beer. And brewed in Georgia, somewhere down in Georgia.
Now I'm almost positive this beer has a direct tie into the quote we're talking that Sean brought up.
It kind of does.
Oh, this is actually good for because it's a Pilsner. It looks light, but it's not bitter. It actually has a little bit of a sweet flavor. Wow, you notice that,
really,
Jason?
I mean, you got really excited when you took that sip.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Because I was expecting this to be.
Right, the surprise. So is it a good beer or is it just surprising?
No, it's a good beer.
It's a good drinking beer. Mm-hmm. You could drink this mowing the lawn, but it's not like an American Pilsner. It's got much more flavor.
Yeah, this is...
So could you drink that mowing the lawn on a riding mower or a push mower?
No, this would be a push mower because you're really thirsty at the end of the day.
Yeah, it depends on the man, but...
You're really thirsty. You come in, you want just a couple of slices of pizza, and this is perfect. This would be perfect.
Now... I have a beer that I sit on the porch and watch somebody else mow.
Oh, see, I wouldn't do that with this one. This is
so mine's a little heavier.
I'd drink a porter for that one. If I'm going to watch somebody else do work.
Yeah. So I went back to the stouts. This is kind of an emergency beer because, I haven't been in the grocery store in a few days and, running out of supplies here during the quarantine. So I had to pull out the back of the fridge beer, but this is the chocolate stout, the Willy Wonka looking.
Oh yeah, I remember stout. That is so cool. I love that can.
Carbock Brewing Company.
Look at that,
and it actually says your golden ticket.
Hold it up
on it.
Isn't that awesome? Willy Wonka, so
proudly,
man.
Proudly brewed in Texas, and it says. Silky smooth, open me, and you'll see a brew that came from our imagination. Let it pour, watch it swirl. The chocolate notes release with carbonation. Take a sip, and you'll agree that this will become your new infatuation.
Yep.
Get it quick. The clock does tick, and this stout will only be there for the season.
That's so definitely a sit on the porch and watch the guy.
It also makes me want to buy it. It's a good slogan.
Good marketing.
Slogan, but yeah, good marketing.
Oh, man, I poured that terribly.
The golden ticket.
I screwed up the pour, man. look at that.
See, I did last time. You did this time. I don't know.
That is a terrible pour. Now it's like I got to get scuba gear to get through the foam.
Well, that's a huge head on that one.
Yeah.
Man. Wow. All
right.
You did yourself well after that root beer.
Yeah. So anyway, this one is a little more stout. So it's, I don't know. Oh, it's only 5.5%. That's weird. I don't understand how beer's alcohol works.
Mm-hmm. So that's a heavy head right there.
Yeah.
Unless you just poured it really bad.
Yeah. I poured it bad for sure. So
I couldn't see it because the camera was missing. So that's when you were like, you spilled it.
Yeah, I didn't get that initial tilt quite right. So it's anyway.
So if I recall, that's a pretty good one because I remember you had it a few weeks back. Yeah.
It is.
All right. So time to get into some. Of course, Jason over here, he's having an emergency too. So we both cracked the glass and pulled out the emergency beer.
All right. Well, desperate times and all. So the quote, insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epics, it is the rule, comes from none other than Mr. Nietzsche.
Nietzsche.
Mr. Frederick Nietzsche.
Oh, man. I was going to say.
I knew it was Friedrich or Frederick.
I was going to say Freud.
I knew he was German. Freud.
I was going to say Freud until you mentioned. When you said 50 years, I'm like, well,
is that Freud. Right? I don't know if I'm right about that.
Freud was like 100 years.
Yeah, when was Nietzsche? I thought he was World War II-ish. Was that not?
Yeah. Well, World War II was like, that was longer than 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's getting on like there
70.
Now.
70. Well, 80.
I'm getting old.
Yep.
Yeah. So
Nietzsche. That sounds like a Nietzsche.
Let's see. Oh, man, I was way off. See, I told you from the last episode I failed history class.
Nietzsche was like it was like early 1900s.
Yeah, 1844 to 1900.
Mm. Yeah, he lived to be an old man.
Yeah, wow. For those days.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so sorry, listeners. Send your hate mail to me again.
Oh, well. And that was before, you think about a quote like that, that was before the Russian Revolution, I guess, back in...
That's the thing. Before we get into the book,
yeah,
everybody thinks like it's as bad as it's ever been today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what's going on. It's always as bad as it's ever been.
Yeah.
It's called recency bias. Mm-hmm. But, and we've had the panics. We had a civil war in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Like, yep. This is not a civil war.
Right.
This is a virus.
Yeah.
And I mean, like,
we had, back in the 1970s, we had gas shortages, so to speak.
Yeah.
So we were told.
Yeah. More conspiracy theory stuff.
I was about to say, don't open that box.
We had two, I mean, get this, back in the 60s, we had a president that was assassinated, you know, a president that was assassinated. And then his brother was assassinated the same decade. I mean, talk about a decade of. Yeah, and Martin. Yeah, I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
And so I think we...
Yeah, the whole civil unrest and, you know, I mean, Cuban Missile Crisis. We had, you know...
Yeah.
Whatever, the bombing drills, you know.
Yeah.
We were talking in the previous episode, you know, as Gen Xers, we grew up with the constant threat of nuclear war throughout the 80s.
That's right.
The Cold War.
The old drill under the desk, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like that was going to do anything.
Hey, yeah. Haven't you seen the latest, you know, Indiana Jones movie? All he needs is a fridge.
Yeah, but they told us not to climb in fridges when we were there, so.
Oh, well.
I mean, now you could because they're all magnetic seal instead of latches, right. But that was old 50s propaganda, not climbing in fridges. You can do it now, kids. It's fine.
It's okay. Totally safe.
Disclaimer, totally we safe. Do not recommend your children climbing into fridges.
Yeah, Jason, you can just be the voice of the legal voice. All right, so let's jump into,
Executive.
We're going to go straight to the back of the book and go to chapter 18.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about, so first of all, before we do that, just so people get a feel for this book, it is called Executive Power, the greatest collection of psychological strategies to create an automatic advantage in any business situation. Just slips right off the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
There are 20 chapters or so, 21 chapters. And like some of the chapters are super spin control, quickly dilute the impact of negative publicity. The foolproof strategy to keep any employee from stealing, chapter 5. Chapter 6, collect money owed no matter how long it's overdue. Like there's some really cool chapters in here.
Yeah.
And he's got like these little step-by-step, very actionable type stuff in every single chapter, which is one of the things I like about it. But for this episode, and because we talk about persuasion and we know, like we said before the show started or as the show was starting, likability is probably one of the best ways to be persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's in your copy, your videos, person to person, which is now illegal. at least within 6 feet.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, my neighbors were out in the yard yesterday.
Yeah.
And like the next door neighbors and the cross the street neighbors were in the same yard. It was reprehensible. And so I go to the kitchen drawer and I pull out my tape measure and I run next door.
That's
and I pull out the tape measure to 6 feet and I'm like, just checking.
Just please checking. Tell me you actually did that.
I did actually.
Oh, I know. Sean would do it.
Awesome.
This guy, anybody that wears a bunny outfit. No, it's a piggy outfit.
I got a pig.
He's got a pink piggy outfit that he wears.
Well, I work.
Yeah, I'm going to need a lot more information on why, but never mind.
I work for capitalism.com, so we're capitalist pigs.
Oh, okay.
That's he all is I a capitalist pig.
That's all I needed.
I wear it on some of the live events and some of the in-person events.
That's awesome.
Which are now illegal.
That's awesome.
So yeah. And I have a unicorn and a doggy, and then I have a rapper persona, which was on Facebook last night as well. So
what would been, I saw that. That was really cool.
Yeah.
So that was really
cool.
Is that your, by the way, I saw the Jeep. Is that your daughter's Jeep now?
That's her Jeep church?
Oh, it's okay. All right, cool.
Yeah.
I was going
to it's tough for a 19-year-old to have a Jeep like that. But, you know, we're in that part of town.
That's good, man. That's great.
All right, so you wanted to talk about this chapter, so I'm going to let you dive into it.
All right, so we're talking, I think it'd be a good idea if we spent maybe a couple of episodes in this book, because there's a lot of, it's hard to just, jump
around.
Yeah, we can jump around. But this particular chapter, I like, because obviously, you know, we talk about persuasion, and we've talked about this one strategy on the show before, but it's the subtle art of mirroring. So people who are not as familiar with mirroring, what does that mean? And mirroring is more or less when you're reacting, portray someone else in their movements and their actions. So Sean, we're here talking, and if you make a certain gesture, or you stand in a certain way, or if you show a certain posture that when we're talking, you know, what I'm trying to do in that behavior is kind of mirror, you know, what your persona is, how you stand, maybe some of the facial expressions that you show. I might try to mirror that as we're having a conversation. And some people may believe that trying to mirror someone else it's a gimmick and it's a trick, and people will pick up on that. But I think what we're going to talk about today is the fact that most people don't pick up on that. It's untraceable.
It's a skill like anything else too.
Sure.
Like it's kind of like, you know, when you learn karate. we'll use a movie reference. So when Ralph Macchio learned karate the first time from Mr. Miyagi, he knew just enough to get his butt kicked.
Right.
Like, I think mirroring is very similar. Like, you hear about it, you don't really practice it. You just kind of go out and do it.
Yep.
You can usually spot it.
Yeah.
But that's usually being spotted by people who know about it, not the general public.
Right.
So, if you're like frantically trying to mirror somebody, like as soon as they change position, you're like trying to match it. That's weird. And it shows up. But if you wait 2 to 3 seconds, like they teach you to do, it's pretty effective.
Yeah. And what's interesting, here's a study. It's called, in this chapter, it's called Drinking It In. And you ever heard of a sports drink named Vigor? Cause I've never heard. Have you?
Vigor?
Not really popular. Maybe it just kind of fell by the wayside.
It's more niche.
Okay.
My sisters drank it for a while.
You
know, they're into CrossFit, so who knows what's going on there, but.
Okay. So So that makes sense. I see it's a sports drink. So it says back in 2008, in a 2008 study, Robin Tanner and Tanner Chartrand, these were psychologists at Duke, demonstrated how social, and they call it, instead of mirroring, they call it mimicry, can influence the behavior of a potential client or investor. So what happened was 37 Duke students were asked to taste this new sports drink named Vigor and answer questions about the product. So the interviewer mirrored the posture and the movement of about half of the participants. All of the participants that were mimicked by the interviewer rated Vigor more favorably and drank more of it. The participants who were not mimicked did not view it as favorable. So the mimic participants were also more likely to say that they would buy it and to predict that it would be a successful drink in the marketplace. So interesting.
Yeah, so same exact drink, same taste, same delivery, same bottle, same everything else. And just because the person you're with acted like you acted.
Yep.
You know, subconsciously you pick up on that and you favor the product more.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty crazy.
It is. It really is. Like, something as simple as that. And it goes back to, like I said, it goes back to, and I have used, again, people can call this manipulation. You can call it manipulation all you want to. I call it likability. It's called building likability. And if you're out there and you're talking with someone, the most likable thing you can do is to, you know, mimic what they typically are doing. And if they're standing, you know, with their, say, for instance, they're using certain facial expressions, you might want to look at that and mimic those facial expressions too. You know, the worst thing you can do is go, you know, go complete opposite, because people kind of look at that when you start to go the opposite of what people normally, what they're used to, you can cause some tension there. And I've seen this, I've seen this happen so many times, you know, and I learned that lesson a long time ago when I got into sales. Sometimes the best thing you can do is find out where people are and kind of ride that, you know, ride that roller coaster with them, however they respond.
So I wonder in this study, and I know it doesn't say in the chapter, but I'd be curious, like if you went into the actual research, you know, 'cause a lot of mirroring people that teach mirroring, they talk about you mirror for a while and then at some point you start leading.
Yeah.
Like once you kind of get that rapport, then you start leading. I wonder if they did that or if it was just straight up mirroring them that worked. It seems like it's just mimicking them, especially since they use the word mimic.
Right.
Because it never says anything about them taking the lead and then leading people. So,
right.
Also, we should probably put in a disclaimer that, you know, please use these tactics for good, not evil.
Not evil.
Especially in these trying times that we're
in.
And follow your government's instructions.
Yes. You know, so if you want to get the last package of toilet paper, make sure you're mirroring the whoever's trying to hoard all the toilet paper. It probably won't work in that situation, but.
No, and so here, yeah, and that's kind of the, you know, on a side note, you have to say it's only in certain situations. In situations of complete chaos, things like this fall apart. You know, things like this don't work. You have to be in the right situation. And typically when you're in a calm situation, and you're in a situation where you're one-on-one with somebody, typically when you're in a situation when you're with multiple people and there's a lot of things going on, this may not work. Because you don't have the ability to capture the other person's attention. They're too distracted. So
their brain's looking around.
Yeah, exactly.
All the threats, all the other stuff going on. But, you know, as we move, I was just thinking, as we move to video and do more and more video with each other, you know, you can use this on video. So for instance, like right now, Jonathan, you're leaning forward, I'm leaning forward, you know, but if the person, it's a longer call or something, you know, they might, especially because they're probably not podcasting, right?
Yeah.
So they're not tied to a mic.
Right.
You know, they might lean back in their chair and you can wait a couple seconds and lean back in your chair. You know, and just, so you may not be able to see their entire body, but you can kind of tell where they're at and you can mimic them in that way.
Yeah. And this doesn't even have to be people. It can be used in all sorts of applications where you're getting mimicked. It may not be an actual person. They were saying in extensive research conducted by Jeremy Balinson at Stanford demonstrates that successful mimickers need not even be human. The goal was to determine how astute people are in detecting digital chameleons, that is, computer agents or avatars who mimic them. So this can be done even in, you know, today. I mean, this book was written quite some time ago, but today we're talking AI. So if you're developing AI that can mimic, you know, people, then that's, you know, you can be successful in that, in the way you persuade, by mimicking your core audience.
And it's not just visual either.
Right.
So it can be audible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can match speech patterns, the speed at which someone's speaking, their pauses, their inflections, you know, if they're finishing up on sentences, if they're finishing down, like all those little cues, you can mimic those. You don't want to be a parrot, but you can certainly mimic the speed. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's, you know, we see that all the time, especially, you know, Jonathan, us being from the South.
Yep.
And, you know, Southerners don't trust people from New York, and New Yorkers think that Southerners are stupid. And it's mainly based on this, on the speech pattern, the speed of speech. Mm. So, you know, I know when I used to sell in home and I would run across somebody that was from the Northeast, mm-hmm. I'd have to very intentionally pick up my cadence
yeah.
of speech in order to keep up with them and keep mm-hmm. them interested. Otherwise they're just bored out of their mind.
Yeah.
Cause they're like, man, is this dumb Southerner ever going to get to his point or, you know, whatever. So, and then I, you know, using that technique, I would try to take over and then slow everything down a little bit
mm-hmm.
so that I was more in my zone. But yeah, yeah, so it's not just visual. It's also, you know, if you're doing a phone call, you can do the same thing.
Yeah. And it works the opposite. Southerners, you know?
Yeah.
I remember the first time I was in a sales call with a company down in, Mississippi. And the guy was like,
slower than Knoxville in Georgia.
Well, I just remember, I remember being on the phone with a plant manager. This was years back, where he says, "Son, you talk way too fast." I was like, and I didn't realize it, you know, because I was just trying to get to the point. But he was just like, "Man, you're talking too fast."
Well, one of the people I work with here in Austin, she's from New Jersey, and mm-hmm. like the speed at which she talks is so much faster than yeah. like I talk.
Right.
And like, you have to slow her down or you mm-hmm. have to get on her pace, one of the two, or else she gets bored and like, you know, the conversation's over. Mm-hmm.
So
you got to know that about people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So yeah. What else do you got from this chapter?
So here's the thing. So like I was saying earlier, most people would think that if you try to mirror someone, they're going to figure it out. So you start mm-hmm. mimicking what the behaviors of other people, and they're going to like, wait a minute, I see what you're doing. You're just trying to mimic what I'm doing. But it turns out humans, according to the study in this chapter, humans are extremely poor at detecting when people or technology is mimicking their behavior. It says a person or computer agent has the ability to move like us or smile like us, and we have no idea that it's occurring. Yet it's a unique and powerful strategy for anyone who's trying to teach us, to sell to us, or persuade us. So the point is that we may think that we can detect when people are doing that. And sometimes when it's completely blatant, if somebody's just trying to mimic us, I mean, there's an obvious way, but if you're simply slowing your speech down, trying to get in line, and I mean the main thing is, like, you know, I go back to one of the classic books is How to Win Friends and Influence People, is like, know your audience and know exactly a little bit about how they if you kind of know from a cultural standpoint. Here in the U.S. we have, I would say, like five major cultures here in the U.S. Like, we got
I think they line up with the Power Five.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we got the Pac-12, we got the SEC. Okay. No, I mean, like, so you got Southerns, then you got in our area, kind of where I live, you got like almost like an intersection of Southern and Appalachian a little bit. Along with some Northern, then you got the Northeastern, then you got the Midwestern, then you've got the, those who are out in the
Southwest.
Far. Yeah, the Southwest.
And then just West.
And then Pacific. And then, yeah, I would just say West and Pacific West would all be in one category. And then you got your Canadians up there. Of course, that's not in the U.S., but it's like,
Then you have Texas.
Yeah, that's like their own.
We're
it's like own an own country. Here. Yeah.
At least we think we are. Like, you can get tortilla, do you know another state where you can get tortilla chips in the store that are shaped like your state? I don't know another state that does that.
That's worth a trip to Texas.
Like, we have Texas shaped stuff for everything.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, it's crazy.
Yep.
But yeah, tortilla chips shaped like Texas. That's a real thing here in Texas.
Hmm.
Well, and that's not an easy shape to make, by the way.
No, it's not. No, I mean,
it's not like Connecticut or something. Mm. Like it's a real shape.
It's a big one too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you've got to understand, it's like, you know, I was on a conference call with a Canadian earlier this week. He was a Canadian business owner. And so he would say,
times are tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And he would say, you know, he would use that A, and you know, what is that? The A? A?
It's got some hosers, eh?
So it was like, yeah, I mean, he was a true Canadian. So it was.
By the way, Jason, I think that was a little more Scottish than Canadian.
It was. I'm still recovering from Paddy's Day. Sorry.
That's right. Sorry, we had a little Paddy's Day that was quickly.
Which isn't even Scottish, but you know.
Yeah. Well, you know.
But here's the thing, you know, if you got to know your audience, and it's key to understanding knowing who you are, who you're dealing with, and some of their cultural norms. Will help you, because here's the thing, and there's a really delicate balance. Really good salespeople are masters at this skill, and it's not, you can call it manipulative, you can call it whatever you want to, but salespeople are some of the best salespeople are masters at this, and that is simply getting people. It's using something called empathy. You know, we've talked about empathy many times in the past, but also having a general understanding, and also at the same time mirroring the tone, the inflection of the person that you're talking to and you're dealing with. That goes a long way in how you make them feel, in the way you make them feel, in terms of your ability to put them at ease and to put them at a very comfortable level.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what he says in this book. So, you know, just a couple of things. One, I would say, don't do this at the expense of being yourself.
Yeah.
Like, you can do this without losing your own personal identity.
Absolutely.
And that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is just from a practical standpoint, he says in the book, he talks about, well, like, how do you start this? How do you start practicing this? And one of the things he talked about was start by mirroring head nods.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when people talking, if there's something you agree with that they're talking about, if you just nod your head yes, kind of in rhythm with them talking, that they'll start nodding sometimes. But if nothing else, it shows that you're mirroring their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not the body language, you're mirroring their idea.
Yeah.
Because you're saying yes to the idea that they're explaining to you. And then you can move into other behaviors like crossing your legs, leaning forward in your chair, leaning forward, you know, on a video call like this, slowing the pace, speeding up the pace of your talking.
Mm-hmm.
But don't do it immediately. Like I said earlier in the show, you start out with like a 4 to 6 second delay. Now, don't be so in your head if you're going to try this. That you're like, one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi. Okay, now I can start. Because then it's going to just come off as awkward.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just got to kind of feel this, you know, there's about a 3 to 4 or 5 second delay.
Yeah.
And you can speed up the delay as you get better at it and as you get confident that people aren't catching on to what you're doing. But the truth is, if you're really empathetic, you're going to do this naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're going to actually be tuned into them.
Yep.
And you're going to just reflexively. There was a study he talked about in here from 2004 during the presidential election. And they did some type of morphing of photos for Bush and Kerry, George Bush and John Kerry. And people like, were attracted to the one that looked most like them, right? Basically.
Yep.
But here's the thing. 2,500 participants in this study, not a single one noticed that their likeness was being morphed into the likeness of whichever person they were looking at. So literally they were changing the picture, from my understanding of this, literally they were changing the picture using the participants' own features.
Yeah.
And they didn't even realize it. Like literally like looking, getting like more looking like they were making it look like they were looking in a mirror, and they didn't even pick up on it. And they, but they started liking the candidate more because they saw themselves literally in the candidate. And 2,500 people, not a single one noticed it.
Wow.
So if it, if it's not noticeable in something like that, you can probably rest assured that it's not going to be too noticeable in more minor things like a head nod, leaning forward in your chair, leaning back in your chair. As long as you don't, you're not jumpy about it, and it looks like you're trying to catch up to them. It's got to be calm and,
well, and genuine. Just
kind of in the flow. Yeah, genuine.
It's people have to feel like it's just natural.
Yeah. And that's one of the bullets he talks about here. He says, in another part of the strategy, he's like, and he references How to Win Friends and Influence People. Be genuinely interested in people.
Yeah.
Smile. Remember a person's name. Be a good listener. Talk in terms of the other person's interest and make the other person feel important sincerely. Like that's basically the whole How to Win Friends and Influence People book in those five or six bullets.
Yeah. So let's talk, because I think this is one way that, you know, and we've talked about, getting back into politics. We've talked about how well, you know, on some past episodes, how well Trump's been in terms of his charisma. His ability to persuade other people through the power of charisma. And he's a master. You got to give him, I mean, you got to appreciate the fact that he has done as well as he has, you know, just at his power, just the persuasive ability that he has. But I'll tell you, I think his polling shows that he's taken some hits the past couple of weeks. And
But you know, I think anybody's going to take a hit in this. I don't care what.
Yeah.
Well, who you are.
Maybe.
I mean, maybe not as hard of a hit, but.
But I think that I'm not one that probably goes into faulting, but I can understand that a lack of humility during a time of a crisis can come back to bite you. And I think certain times like this, your poll numbers are probably going to take a hit if you're not showing empathy and humility and being genuinely concerned with other people. Although I think that over the last week, I don't know if someone gave him some advice or maybe it's been pretty genuine where he's come in and say, kind of reversed the tune. And I think he's taken on the role of as a good leader as best he can. And in this situation,
I've definitely noticed a different pace and tone. I do think there's still some of the arrogance there, for sure,
of course,
which is probably what the polling numbers. But there's definitely a different pace in his briefings and a different pace when he's on camera.
Yeah,
it's a little more serious.
Yeah,
but I think these glimpses of like the arrogance are like because he's really trying hard to control it and to be presidential.
Right.
And then stuff like Kung Flu and Chinese virus comes out and like, you know, and then once he says it, because he's who he is,
right,
like he's gonna double down on it.
Yeah.
And then the humility goes out the window.
Yeah, it does. It's just like he was tweeting out his like latest poll numbers.
Yeah.
It's like, it's probably not the best time to be tweeting out your increasing. I think he was tweeting out, and I'm not sure where he got the polling from because I haven't seen this, but it was extremely high for his approval. And I'm like, despite that, I mean, that's great and everything, but despite that, it's probably not the best time to be, you know, throwing that out there. Is like, my poll numbers are great and everything. And I'm like, yeah, maybe a different time. Maybe on the, on the upswing.
Yeah. And he got elected on Make America Great Again.
Yeah. Yep.
Not on I'm Great.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And he's, you know, it's easy to forget that. So, you know, we talked about, and that's why Obama won. And mm-hmm. he was like, hope and change.
Yeah.
Wasn't right. about him. It was about hope and change. And then Hillary came along and it was about I'm with Hillary.
Yep. Terrible.
And nobody cared.
Terrible message.
So, yep. Right. So he's kind of, you know, he was all about, you know, let's mm-hmm. like, he needs to like, let's kill the virus
yeah.
type slogan as opposed yeah. to look at my poll numbers.
Right.
Yep. And, or we're in this together type mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah. That, I think that's the right message at this present time.
Yeah.
He can talk poll numbers after we're, you know, over this, you know, exactly. when we're on the upside after, you know, after we come out of this, but probably not the best time when we're right in the thick of it. just my observation,
especially
but
especially when you have New York's governor praising you, you might want to latch on to that time. If you're that specific person, you know,
might want to rethink that. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying that if you were getting support from the other side of the aisle, no matter which side you reside on, you might want to latch hold of that.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. not drive a wedge.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, in this chapter, he talks about the author talks about the six keys to humility.
Yes, those are really good.
Yeah, they're really good. I mean, some of them sound like, you know, stuff your grandfather would tell you. Like it's just kind of common sense stuff, which is one thing I like about this author. He brings a really good mix of just common sense practicality and scientific study together. And it's like when, like, the first keys to humility, when you or those around you think a job is beneath you, do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so you think the job is beneath you. Great. That's fine. But if you're trying, remember the name of the chapter is The Art of Charisma and, you know, creating likability. Well, you do the job anyway, you know?
Yep.
If you're trying to inspire and persuade people.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And look at the second key. Nothing brings out awe like someone admitting that they were wrong. This is where, and like, I think Trump's done a great job. So I'm not trying to bash him, but I'm saying if he wanted to improve his poll numbers, he could instantly improve them, I believe, by being humble enough to say, you know what, I made some mistakes. Here's where I was wrong. You know, maybe not taking this thing serious enough in the early beginnings, but I realized my error and we are full force on this thing right now. Yeah. So, you know, something as simple as that would probably show, I mean, would just be powerful enough for people who even hate him to say, you know what, you know, I can overlook yeah, that. Some people won't.
It's hard some people won't, but it's hard not to at least respect it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You may not like the person, but you got to at least respect that action. Right. It's kind of like I mentioned on the last episode, Ryan Dice from Digital Marketer sent out an email apologizing basically for, they had an email already queued up, already written, scheduled 2 weeks out.
Right.
And didn't think to go back with all the stuff because they were just in crisis control with their own employees, getting them set up to work from home and all that stuff. So they just missed that this email was going out with a specific tone and message.
Yeah.
At a time when people were already freaking out and doing other stuff. And it wasn't anything bad. They were just removing a product from a group of products.
Yeah.
But it felt insensitive when you read it, given the current situation.
Sure.
So the next day he sends out an email apologizing and explaining all of that. You know, well, here's what happened. We'd already written this email. We had it pre-programmed for the autoresponder. You know, all these different things. And then he apologized, admitted what he's wrong, admitted why it happened so people could see it. Yep. And then he fixed it by giving up, you know, a different option.
Yeah.
And I thought that was like just really well done.
Absolutely.
The way he handled that.
Yeah.
Which kind of also falls into number three in the six keys to humility, which is don't pretend you know everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, we didn't know this was going to happen. We didn't know we should have done. Mm-hmm. We didn't realize we should have gone back through every autoresponder and checked it. Like, which is something our last guest, Dr. Michelle, talked about. Like, maybe you need to audit your automatic messaging stuff right now and make sure it's not saying something really insensitive based on the current times, you know? Especially if you use a lot of humorous tones and stuff, because it may not fly right now.
So, yeah, sometimes it's amazing that sometimes people are just afraid to say, I don't know. They feel like they have to know everything or have an answer prepared for everything, when sometimes simply I don't know will just suffice, you know?
I've made some of my biggest sales as a coach when I've said, I don't know.
I don't know.
Like literally, like, cause I kind of, my high end one-on-one coaching is kind of very intuitive and it's just based on what's going on with them that week.
Yep.
And there's, so people in the enrollment call will be like, oh, what are we going to talk about every week? And I'm like, I don't know. Depends on what's going on for you that week.
Right.
Like there's no modules, there's no set curriculum. Sure. Like your life is the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever's showing up for you is what we'll deal with. And
so how do they respond?
Oh, they love it.
Yeah. I can see
true.
That. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what, I mean, it'd be actually.
That probably puts people at ease, you know,
it does.
Knowing that you're not like, you're not a robot.
There's a lot more lying out there than truth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think everybody at this point knows that the 5-step formula for whatever probably is not going to work for most people. And they've tried enough of them without
different.
Results.
Yeah.
But if somebody comes along and says, well, you know, actually there's not a formula. We just kind of figure it out as we go.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like relief in that because it just rings so true and so honest.
Yeah.
Cause it is true and honest.
Yep. You know,
in most things, the 5-step formula, now I think there are, you could have 5 principles that you walk people through. That's different. But if you're talking about a 5-step formula or techniques or whatever, that's a little less true. But if it's a surefire principle, but even then, like you don't know which principle to focus on in somebody's business or in a sales conversation or whatever, unless you're having an honest, open conversation. And if you're not willing to say, I don't know, when you go into that conversation, then you're already losing.
Yeah.
But if you go into any given conversation, any sales conversation, anything with the willingness to not know the answer, that's a really powerful place to be, I think. And it makes it, I mean, we're talking about likability here. I mean, that's
right.
Like that's hard for a lot of people to do. And if
it's extremely hard
to say that, like it instantly, people are like, wow.
When I first got into sales and did consulting work, I felt like I had to have all the answers. And when people said it, unfortunately, you know, and this goes back to, you know, basically calling out your own mistakes, but in some cases I would just say I have to make things up or feel like I have to, like, you know, and I would give some bad answers to people that had questions, all because I just felt that, you know, and in going back, I can't believe I would say stuff like that. I should have said, you know, it would have been much better had I said, I don't know, but I can find out for you.
Yeah.
You know, and follow up on that instead of saying something that you're not sure is the answer that you think may be the answer, but not 100% sure. And just so you can give them an answer and make yourself feel good and make them feel good about you.
Yeah. Cause it's really hard to go back.
Yeah. Once you've done that, you've really hurt yourself.
Yeah. Cause now you got to go back and say, yeah, that thing I said, it's like, it's harder to admit you're wrong than it is to admit you don't know.
Yep. Yep.
Like, especially down the road.
Mm-hmm.
In the moment, it feels easier to say the thing that you're not sure about and to not admit you're wrong. But long term, I promise you, the I don't know now is easier than the I was wrong later.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, that's quotable right there. Mm-hmm. That is quotable. So,
all right, so last strategy, if we're talking about, still talking about humility, mm-hmm. Self-deprecating humor is still, mm-hmm. I would say self-deprecating humor is one of the most powerful strategies because there's nothing more persuasive, in my opinion, than someone who is able to not take themselves seriously and able to take, you know, kind of poke fun at themselves, because that takes away all the pretensions that some people have, you know, that people might think you have. So if you can, you know, poke fun of yourself, if you can laugh at yourself, that really gains a lot of likability from the other person, because they know you're not trying to be somebody. They know that you're just, hey man, I'm who I am. And we naturally like or gravitate to those who are not self-absorbed, those who are not egotistical. And one of the best ways you can show that is by making fun of yourself. So don't be afraid to do that.
Yeah. I bet you're really good at that, aren't you?
I am fantastic.
You got so much to work with.
I got enormous amount of material. I've got a friend who I went to school with, and he's one that if I had gleaned from anybody in terms of, you know, this particular lesson right here, is he's a comedian now, and he and I went to school. He went to Georgia Tech. I think he does a lot of work from home now as kind of a computer guy. He writes a lot of code for companies and stuff like that. Works from home. Lives out
single.
On a
goal.
No, not actually, single. He's got no, no, no. Wow. He's got.
He went to Georgia Tech, so I figured he was single.
No, he's not single. He's got like six kids, and he homeschools their kids. They live out on a, like, 200-acre farm. They raise goats, but he does humor, and he constantly, you know, big part of his humor that's so funny is that he makes fun of like himself as a stay-at-home, you know, a guy that's got six kids, homeschooled dad on a farm.
Gaffigan.
Oh yeah, 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 and exactly. And Jim Gaffigan's one of the funniest guys out there, but if you watch his humor, it's so self-deprecating. It's not even funny.
Most of it.
Yeah. And people appreciate them. Now, you compare that kind of humor with some of the guys that you listen to, if you ever scan the channels of XM, some of the comedy channels that are just raunchy humor, and it's just, you know, you can listen to it for like 2 seconds and you're flipping channels.
Or the roast type stuff, you know, which is...
funny, but
it's
easy.
Funny as a one-liner,
right?
But it gets old really quick.
It gets really easy. Yeah,
like you can throw in a one-liner in a series in a conversation that's, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and it's really funny. Mm-hmm. But to do it over and over, it just gets old.
It really does,
and uncomfortable for most.
And then people. And then you don't like the person. You know,
yeah.
How many people like those comedians?
Yeah,
they may think a little bit of what their act is, like you said, a little bit of their one-liners are funny. But in the end, most people like Jim Gaffigan simply because he's just a likable person. He pokes fun of him at himself all the time.
Yeah. Tosh.0 comes to mind as
the
kind goat. Of crude humor that it's like he's funny, uncomfortably so,
very.
But I'm like, I need a shower after I listen to him. It's like oh my god, I feel guilty for laughing. Like that's. Yeah. Jim Gaffigan's a good example. He, you know, makes fun of the fact that he wants to take a nap while his kids are doing something or whatever, like all those things. So
that he is fat, you know,
he's fat,
he just claims it, you know?
Yeah.
So
there's a ton of good stuff in this book, and we'll do a couple more episodes.
Absolutely.
You know, one thing that's in this chapter that I think is worth talking about at this time is the power of a smile. So we're not going to, that's pretty simple and self-explanatory. I don't think we need to get into a lot of detail there, but, you know, I think right now people really need smiles when you're at the grocery store.
Sure.
I've got a friend who her daughter works at a grocery store And they're working very long hours with agitated people right now. And those cashiers are just getting worn out. So, you know, be kind to cashiers when you do make it to the store. Not just now in this time, but like ever. That's a pretty thankless job. Gas station attendants, cashiers, all those kind of things. Just smile and just smile more, because it just makes you feel better. Makes the other person feel better. It's just a good thing to do, and it makes you more likable. And it actually makes you like yourself more. So spend a few minutes, or not a few minutes, but it's funny. Right now, I've got my life coach has me doing this thing where I have to look at myself in the mirror for 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes in the afternoon or evening, and just listen to the thoughts that go around. And it's pretty interesting. Like,
five minutes,
pretty hard on ourselves.
Yeah.
So when I start really beating myself up, I have to like just smile at myself to cut the chatter. So yeah, I mean, if it works for yourself, it'll work for somebody else as well. So definitely smile more and practice smiling.
You hear that, Jason?
A real smile.
I'm writing it down, actually.
Smile more. Okay.
Well, not smiling, but smiling at myself. Curious about the effects of that. So
it's pretty powerful, I'll tell you.
I'm listening. I'm writing it down, setting alarms. Yeah.
For 4 days now, it's pretty. I know Matt Fury had a thing where he did that too. He talked about like a big toothy smile for 60 seconds in the mirror and making eye contact with yourself.
Yeah.
And like, it's a lot harder to do than you think it is. It's pretty crazy.
Well, it goes along. I heard a very wise man once talk about standing in a, you know, not flexing, but standing in the power stance, you know, shoulders back, just the confident stance, and Superman how doing pose. That for a minute, a couple times a day can drastically improve your confidence and things like that. So,
yeah, there was a TED talk on that too.
Oh, was it a TED talk? Oh.
Yeah.
It's like the Bruce Wayne pose.
Yeah. The Bruce Wayne or the Superman pose or the any superhero basically.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, it's Friday. In the middle of the crisis, I'm out of beer. You're out of beer. We're all out of beer. So time to wrap the show up.
All right. Well, it's been fun. And I want to mention that book again. It's called Executive Power. We'll post it on our show notes for this week. There you go. Sean's holding up a copy right there. And good book. It's definitely worth a read. Not a recent book, but it's what would you compare this book to? It's kind of like a Cialdini type book.
Yeah, to me, it definitely leans more like a textbook. It's not like a sit down and read. It's not full of a lot of fluffy stories. It has a lot of study references.
Which I love. Some people are not a fan of that, but I love case studies.
Yeah, I like this. I like the actual scientific studies, you know, that they reference and things like that. So to me, it's almost like a textbook on persuasion. I feel a little guilty saying it's like Eugene Schwartz's, you know, Breakthrough Advertising. I mean, that's specifically for marketing and copy. I think this is, I don't know if it's that good for persuasion, but it's that style where it's got like the 5 points of this and, you know, these factors and those factors. It feels the same as that book.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, as always, to all of our listeners out there, thanks for listening. As always, Sean, until next time, we'll continue maybe another episode on this book and we'll bring it to a close.
All right. See ya.
All right. See ya.